by the time you put those two components together, the return on capital profiled in the US can actually be quite a bit higher than it is in Canada. And you might overlay that, well, if the risk in Canada were lower, then that might be okay. But that's not true. The risk profile, I would say, is quite comparable.
Welcome to The Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is number 129, episode 129 of The Flux Capacitor. I've been chatting with the industry's business leaders, thought leaders, new market players, and stakeholders, the folks that have been pondering the future of how we create, move, trade, and use energy, and what the future changes will mean for electricity companies, regulators, society, and customers. I hope these conversations have given you, the listener, a sense of the conversations that are taking place in the sector. My guest on the podcast today is
Scott Balfour, President and CEO of Emera.
Scott joined me for a chat about Emera's growth from a privatized crown corporation in Nova Scotia to a major North American energy player with operations in Canada, Florida, New Mexico, Grand Bahama, and Barbados. We discussed the challenges of balancing reliability, sustainability, and affordability in the energy sector, and differences in rates of return. Scott emphasized the need for honest conversations about the costs of decarbonization and the importance of nation-building projects. We close the conversation with Scott's book recommendation. Here is my conversation with Scott Balfour, recorded on Zoom in mid-November 2023. Scott, welcome to the podcast. I'm looking forward to having a conversation about Emera.
Great to be here. Look forward to the discussion.
So maybe right at the outset for the listener, if you could maybe just do a bit of a thumbnail sketch about who Emera is, because unless people are either on the East Coast or following the financial community in the stock market, they may not know Emera as a name in the electricity sector necessarily. I'm very familiar with it because I was around in this sector in 1992, back when Nova Scotia Power was privatized. So maybe for the listener, a little bit about where Emera is in the North American energy space now.
Yeah, so you certainly got the year and the start right, Francis. So in 1992, Government of Nova Scotia took the integrated electric utility, Nova Scotia Power, into the public markets. And Emera has really grown from there. The Emera brand started in 2000, really as a vehicle in order to grow beyond Nova Scotia Power and beyond Nova Scotia. Today we have 7,600 employees as we own and operate a number of regulated electric and gas utilities. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, Nova Scotia, I'm sitting here in Halifax, Nova Scotia, as we chat, where Emera's head office is today, and of course, Nova Scotia Power. But we have other assets here in Atlantic Canada, gas and electric transmission assets in particular, and an energy marketing and trading business called Emera Energy, all headquartered here in Halifax. But then most of our business today is actually not in Halifax, in fact, not in Canada. Almost 70% of our business today is in the state of Florida, where we have a electric utility, Tampa Electric, that serves about 850,000 customers, and a gas utility that serves about half of the gas connected customers in the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. We also have a gas utility in New Mexico, which we have currently contracted for sale, is going through a regulatory process to complete that. And we also own electric utilities in Grand Bahama and Barbados. So in total, about 2.5 million customers across all of those varying operations.
All right. That is pretty expansive considering that you started off with a Crown Corporation in Nova Scotia that was simply privatized in 1992. So I think it's interesting that as you say, 70% of your business is in Florida, and you're in all of these different places, but home is still Halifax.
Yep, that's certainly true. It means, a few of us spend a lot of time on the road and in airports and airplanes and the like as we travel about. And as you also mentioned, of course, we are publicly traded still widely held. There's no principal shareholder. We trade on the TSX. We're one of the TSX 60 companies, meaning we're one of the largest publicly traded companies in the country. But most recently, we also listed in New York, so we are dual listed now. And but we're still proud to call Nova Scotia home.
So that's, I mean, when you kind of step back and look at the sweep and everything that's happened in the past 33 years, that's an astonishing growth for the company.
Yeah, and I think it's a story that Canadians should be proud of and Nova Scotians should be proud of. We're punching above our weight a little bit and competing against some of the largest energy companies in North America. And for coming out of humble beginnings of one of the smaller provinces in the country, and to be in this place now where we're amongst energy leaders in North America in our sector. It's it's a prideful place to be.
But I couldn't agree more. As I say, it's quite astonishing when you think that it simply began as the privatization of a moderately sized Crown corporation, three decades ago. But I think it also gives you a unique perch from which to observe what's taking place in the energy sector, because you're, while headquartered in Halifax, you're in, I don't know, four different time zones, from depending upon where your assets are. You're covering a lot of geographic area, a lot of different types of markets as well. So that's got to give, like, both, I mean you personally, Scott, but also, your management team probably has a different perspective because of sort of the expansive and broad geographic area that the company covers.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think in many ways that helps to make us better because we can bring experiences from different jurisdictions and different businesses and different teams and different regulators and different economies and bring those lessons to bear in operations across the business. And we will often also move members of our team. We'll sometimes spend time in one business and then time in another, and that too helps the development of talent, of course, but I think it also helps us to be better as a business.
And then are the businesses all regulated, or are some of these also in the non-regulated space? What does that look like?
Yeah, so we are today 95% of our earnings are regulated. Our one unregulated business would be the reference that I made to Emera Energy, which is a marketing and trading business where we principally as a gas-focused business, principally in the Northeast USA. That's sort of certainly where the heart of the business is. It now has expanded further, and mostly what we're doing is moving other people's gas along gas transmission assets that we have effectively rented for a period of time. And so we'll move, 3 BCF of gas a day on average, where the business has become quite meaningful. And it's relatively a small component of our business, of course, but still an important part of our business and helps us to stay sharp. It's a competitive market-facing business, and those are skills that are helpful in terms of the development of talent within an industry that is not typically known for its sort of competitive mentality, although I think it's actually really important in the regulated industry too. But it also gives us insight into different markets that business is active in as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, the bulk of your stuff is in regulated businesses. Any observations about, you know, because not to kind of pick on Nova Scotia, but seeing as how this is, you know, the podcast that tends to focus on Canadian electricity. So you're seeing regulation and regulatory constructs in multiple jurisdictions. Generally, how do you see us doing in Canada? You know, because I know you've got insight into other markets as well. Are we, you know, when it comes to regulatory innovation, are we leaders? Are we followers? Are we stuck in the 1960s? Just because, I mean, you can do a compare and contrast from the other jurisdictions that you're in. How are we doing in this space?
I think we have an opportunity to improve. If I were to, you know, put it in those terms, and you know, if I had a worry, Francis, sort of seeing what's going on in the sector, and even frankly beyond the sector, mm-hmm. but the demand for capital, mm-hmm. The need for capital investment, is at levels we've never seen before.
Right.
And so, you know, that capital is going to go to places where the risk return balance and profile makes the most sense, where sort of the certainty of and confidence in the market makes the most sense. And so, you know, in that context, you know, I would advocate that there's opportunities for us to improve. I know certainly federally the focus on permitting reform, you know, is an important aspect. But I think even as it relates to electricity regulation, you know, I think there's opportunities to improve, and we would see where it is, you know, more effective in some markets. Also happen to be the markets that you know, seeing capital being attracted to. Right. I think that's a difference maker.
Yeah. Should we be, you know, taking, I don't know, a message from the fact that the bulk of your growth has been not in Canada, but in other jurisdictions? When you're talking about the risk profile and the returns are kind of what drive this. Is there an implicit message in this that we don't have maybe as much opportunity, or is it just our market's too small? And if you want to get big, you've got to kind of grow outside as well.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of both in that. So if I start with a second point, I mean, as you would know, most of the if I focus on electric utilities for a second, most of the electricity utilities in Canada, most of them are Crown Corps. They're government owned, either by provinces or municipalities in some cases. And so for an investor-owned utility company like Emera, you know, it's not like we can go to Saskatchewan and say, hey, we're here, you know, we'd like to own a piece of that business. There are many, many more, the much more prominence of investor-owned utilities as a construct in the U.S. So it's no surprise that companies like Emera and Fortis. And Algonquin is another example have been investing in utility growth in the U.S. So that's certainly part of it. Mm-hmm. But the second part of it, yes, you know, as we sit, you know, here in Canada, across the country, on average, the return on capital profile for investing in utilities in Canada is lower than what it is in the U.S. Right. Our equity thicknesses are generally lower. You know, generally the equity thickness, the equity component of the capital structure that is invested on behalf of customers, generally in Canada is 40% equity and 60% debt. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., generally, it's 50-50.
Okay.
And then the return on equity profile in Canada is generally a little bit lower than it is in Canada. By the time you put those two components together, the return on capital profiled in the US can actually be quite a bit higher than it is in Canada. And you might overlay that, well, if the risk in Canada were lower, then that might be okay. But
Right.
that's not true. The risk profile, I would say, is quite comparable between the US and Canada on average. There are, there are differences depending on which location specifically you're in. So that's a, that's a factor for sure. But today, for Emera, 80% of our capital, it's 68% of our business is in Florida, but 80% of our capital is being invested in Florida. And
Right.
the, what I just mentioned is, sure, that is part of it. Our investors are certainly, when they see the return on capital in Florida being higher, they would encourage us to invest more of their capital there. But I'd also say part of it is just the Florida economy is growing, the customer base is growing, the need to invest is there. And so part of it is just sort of the natural state of strength in that Florida market that is also driving the need for higher levels of capital.
So I want to talk about sort of the moment, the pivotal moment that we're at with respect to energy and but before that, Scott, I wanted to ask you about your journey. And so I ask everybody who comes on the podcast, I make the joke, Scott, when you were a kid in the playground, is this what you dreamed of doing? What was your journey to your role now at Emera?
Yeah, so I grew up in Ontario. I didn't grow up in Nova Scotia, and no,
Okay,
I
so
did not.
that's why you're a Leafs fan, is that
Yeah,
it?
yes, that's true. From long ago, many days, I have been hoping that maybe one day the Leafs can make it a little further through a playoff run. But I'm also a fan of the Tampa Bay Lightning, as you might imagine.
Well, I guess, yeah.
Of course, is that Tampa Electric is our biggest business,
Yeah.
and it's not lost on me that they also have a jersey that is the same blue and white colors as the Maple Leafs, and so it makes it a little easier to cheer on that team as well. And so, but to answer your question, no, I did not grow up thinking that I would be have a career in the energy or utility sector. I started my career in banking in Toronto, working for a couple of banks in Toronto, and then left there to work for one of my clients at the time, which today is a large construction company. I spent 17 years working for what was Armbro. It was now Aecon, sort of pan-Canadian, now even beyond that. Construction, self-performed construction engineering firm, and left Aecon after 17 years. Joined Emera 13 years ago. Was recruited, and was compelled by a little bit of the Emera story. And it had already demonstrated its growth beyond Nova Scotia. Its ability to think a little more broadly and boldly than you might traditionally think of a utility company. And I've had the privilege and pleasure to work with an amazing team here, with the support of a terrific board of directors that has and played a part in shaping some of the growth and success of Emera over the last 13 years.
So let's talk about that moment that we're experiencing in the energy sector. And I guess in a lot of ways we're talking about as a country where Canada as is I think the Prime Minister talks about we're at a hinge moment with respect to the budget and the finances and a number of other things. Some folks in the energy sector, particularly the electricity sector, say we're on the verge of massive growth. This is an inflection point. But I know in some of the messages that we exchanged prior to getting on this call, I thought it would be interesting to talk about the pivotal moment there that we're having here in the industry when, thinking about the energy trilemma, for example. So what's your perspective on what that moment is, and where we're at?
Yeah, so I think really, we're at a place where, it's not that long ago people might have thought of this sector, of our sector, as a bit of, a bit sleepy, the utility sector, and that is definitely not true today. And you refer to the energy trilemma, which is a complex thing that, frankly, it may have even gotten more complex over the last couple of years. So people, the trilemma would generally be described as the intersection of a need to focus on reliability, sustainability, or sort of cleaner energy, and affordability, all at the same time. I'd say the sustainability or cleaner aspect of it has gotten more complicated over the last couple of years from a policy perspective. Certainly, that would be true in the U.S. to contrast the U.S. and Canada and the drivers around that. I'd say just availability of energy is increasingly, part of the conversation, and energy providers in this country included, and in the U.S. Unexpectedly now worried about, making sure that there is just enough supply available given the growing demand that is happening, as you say, this sort of massive increase in demand. And affordability is, as critical as it's ever been. Affordability well beyond the cost of electricity is a challenge, whether it's groceries or housing or just the cost of living. But the cost of energy and electricity is a really important factor in that. And balancing all of those things at the same time is really hard. As you know, we can invest in reliability and make, improvements in the reliability that our customers experience. But the more we invest in it has an impact on the cost because, of course, that is a factor. And the same thing as it relates to the pace at which we clean the generation mix in the energy that we supply. The faster we do that, the higher and more dramatic the cost impacts will be, the more pressure we put on affordability. And so measuring the pace at which we're making these reliability investments, the pace at which we're making energy transition to cleaner energy, and even the pace at which we are adding to the generation capacity in order to meet the increasing demand, these are all factors that we have to balance against affordability. And that's the trick, that's the challenge, and that's what utilities across this continent, frankly, probably globally, are wrestling with at this time, and a big part of the focus for the team.
You mentioned globally. I participated in the International Electricity Summit a month ago, and so Canada, the United States, Europe, Japan, Australia, and I was struck with precisely that there's that the same challenges that we're faced with here are virtually the same challenges wherever you go.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously there's some markets like Germany that had a lot of attention because of their rapid transmission to renewables, and then their journey with nuclear, and the conversation has changed dramatically. And we see jurisdictions, here in North America too, that the conversation is different today than it was just a few years ago around how we think about all these things and how we best manage them.
Well, and the conversation generally here in Canada has now shifted to what the federal government is referring to as nation building projects. But I mean, you have been involved recently in what one would consider a pretty significant nation building project that is bringing electricity from Labrador down into Nova Scotia. So you've got some experience in this space when we're talking about getting big major nation building projects put together. This isn't easy, is it?
No, and truthfully, it's probably going to get harder. And sort of building these things, permitting and First Nation consultation, contractor capacity, would be an increasing challenge that I think we're going to collectively face within this sector and others is you know is an important consideration in navigating this journey ahead. And you know the focus on nation building infrastructure is exactly the right thing at exactly the right time. It sort of I applaud all of that, but this too will, there's a cost factor that there's going to have to be a balance if it's, if it's infrastructure that is relevant in our sector, sort of the balance around how does that get paid for? Is that paid for by customers? Is that paid for by taxpayers? How do we do that in the most cost-effective way? Will be, these are important questions to answer.
So, at the same time, this is against a background of I think a shifting discussion around sustainability and what our objectives need to be in the sustainability space. You mentioned the trilemma earlier, and it feels as though we've been in a period. I don't know, perhaps the last decade where the was the thumb on the scale for one versus the other. But what is the concern about affordability for customers and the need for reliability? Is that going to result in a kind of a shifting balance between these? And what would that do with respect to our sustainability targets?
Yeah, so I think a really important part of the conversation around navigating those sometimes competing forces, particularly as it relates to sustainability, is to have an honest conversation around what the cost is. And it's been, my worry for a while as it relates to the focus on cleaning the electric sector in Canada to drive the electric sector towards net zero is we're having that conversation without talking about the cost and without talking about the fact that the Canadian electric sector is already one of the cleanest in the
In the
world.
world,
It's 85%, 86% non-emitting today, and non-emitting a little different, as than saying renewable because we include nuclear in that. That number. We don't have nuclear in Nova Scotia, but including nuclear in that number, and that's second amongst G7 nations, only behind France, and third amongst the G20. I mean, it is incredibly clean sector. We are twice as clean as the U.S. system, as an example. And so to have an honest conversation to say, okay, what is the cost and the value of moving from 85, 86%. Not emitting to 100. And the reality is every step closer to 100 gets incrementally more expensive and harder.
More
And
expensive
so
and
I think
diminishing returns,
exactly right. So I think we need to have an honest conversation around that from a policy perspective. And to be clear, as it relates to that incremental cost, are customers prepared to pay for it? If not, is it a taxpayer cost? And how do we navigate that journey is I think a really important part. But I'd also say it's certainly if we talk to our customers, and certainly that would be true in Nova Scotia, yes, but even more true as we move into the US. The sustainability part of the provision of electricity would fall a very distant third to affordability and reliability. That those two, depending on the day, might sort of balance each other out as to which one is first or second, but they are very close. The sustainability, at least what we hear from our customers, would be a distant third. And I think that's a truth across most of the sector based upon some of the polling and data that we have seen. But from a policy perspective, it plays a little higher. In Canada, and we respect that, but that's where I think the honest conversations around the cost and how it gets paid for is important to work our way through.
And do you think those conversations are happening, or
I
are we getting a little more honest in these honest conversations?
yeah, I think we are. I think we are getting a little closer to having the candid, honest conversation around all of this, and We're not all the way there yet, I don't think, but I do I like your words. I do think we are closer to that. I think, a little more pragmatic view around some of this. And look, the reality is the sector is going to naturally continue to decarbonize because the technology is getting better, the cost profile of some of these technologies is getting better. It will happen naturally. And that, if we look at our journey in Florida as an example, there are no carbon emission target requirements. There's no renewable energy standard requirements. There is no price on carbon. And yet, we have dramatically reduced the emission profile of the generation mix in Florida because it's been economic. We put solar in place because we could justify the cost of those solar investments in a cost reducing way relative to the alternative sources of adding new generation. We are closing coal units and replacing them with more efficient natural gas generation that is saving customers money. So along that journey, of course, we've reduced the emission profile as well. It is happening naturally. It's a matter of when policy starts to accelerate the need to navigate that journey is the part that I refer to the need for honest conversation around the cost and who pays for it.
You'd also suggested that it's complex and time-consuming to go through the permitting processes, and I know that's something that the federal government, the new federal government is attempting to address with Bill C-5 and the creation of the Major Projects Office. I would imagine this would be heading in the right direction based upon some of your comments, where the at least the aspiration to make it easier to get things built.
Yes, I think that's true. That's true, and I will say, and I applaud the Prime Minister Carney and the focus on this, and Minister Hodgson as well. And it is important. I will also say our experience in Nova Scotia has actually been pretty good, and sort of the permitting and environmental assessment process in Nova Scotia. It has actually been pretty effective, and one of our messages has been to the federal government is should look across the country and take a look at the best practices from across the country, and there may be some models, and I think this is an area actually where the government of Nova Scotia has done a pretty good job, and our experience in that journey has it's in a good place.
Okay. Well, and now here's a maybe a question out of left field for you, Scott. But I looking at the success that Emera has become when it started off as a Crown corporation, privatized in '92, and has now grown to be this this major player on a North American basis. Do you occasionally get phone calls from premiers of provinces that have crown corporations that call and ask how Nova Scotia Power Emera did it, and if there's a template that they could be looking at?
So no, although, but it is interesting, to contrast the investor-owned utility model from the Crown government-owned model. And look, there's advantages and disadvantages to both, and there's good examples and bad examples, of course, of or more challenged examples of both. But I think again in this environment where the need to invest is never been higher. There are some of those government, and if I think about some of the larger municipally owned utilities in the U.S. as an example, maybe to disconnect it from things too close to home to desensitize the discussion a little bit. But the need to invest is very significant, and if you're a municipality and you need to invest in the utility, you try to balance that at the same time as your need to invest in roads and bridges and water systems and schools, and that that can be a challenge. And so I think that there's no right or wrong answer in this. I think maybe to turn your question around a little bit, I think one of the other interesting things to observe. Today, the issue of affordability is almost a hot button issue in some markets. You'll know back a few years ago, there was a challenge here, even in Nova Scotia, with a concern from the premier around the cost of electricity and the increase in rates and an engagement in that process. Starting to see some of those same themes in a few places in the U.S. There's some markets today that are, balancing the data center-driven activity and the impacts that that's having on customer cost. And in the U.S., it's interesting to see what's happening in markets that are, quote unquote, deregulated, where the generation profile is separated from the transmission and distribution, where a regulated utility would continue to do distribution and transmission, but a competitive market would be set up for the generation. Some of those markets in the U.S. are struggling with that model today because some of those generators are saying, "I'm happy to serve a large load data center." And then all of a sudden, the more socialized system, the regulated system, finds itself struggling to meet the generation needs and needing to make capital investments and putting incremental pressure on costs. And we're seeing some political activity arise as a result of some of that dynamic. So lots of interesting things going on in the sector.
Yeah, absolutely. So the last question, Scott, I ask everybody the same final question, and that's for a book recommendation. And we've got our Flux Capacitor book club. We put the list together. So today, what book will you be adding to our reading list?
Well, I'm gonna get there in half a step, Francis.
Okay.
And I had the opportunity recently to listen to Mustafa Soliman,
okay,
who is currently the CEO of Microsoft AI, but has had a career in the AI sector before. And he just recently published an essay that has led me to a book recommendation that I haven't read yet, but I've read the essay. And the essay is called "Build AI for People, Not to Be a Person." And it's pretty thought-provoking. And this whole, where AI is going, it's a little bit of a cautionary tale, frankly. And so he's got a book as well that predates this essay, a little more thematically around sort of the cautionary tale of AI from someone who has been an architect of AI and continues to drive the focus of AI. And his book that I have not yet read, but is now on my reading list, is called The Coming Wave.
Okay, so The Coming Wave, and it is by
Mustafa Soliman, who is the CEO of Microsoft AI, and I would also recommend the essay.
Gotcha. Okay. I've got it on my screen, The Coming Wave, and it is Mustafa Soliman and Michael Bhaskar as the two authors. But The Coming Wave. That is an excellent and timely addition. And so we'll put that on our reading list. That's terrific, Scott. And thank you for the recommendation, but also thank you for jumping on the podcast to, giving us some insight into your view and kind of an Emera view, because it is a different perspective given, all of the different markets that you're involved in. Appreciate you taking the time to chat.
It was fun. I enjoyed it. Thank you, Francis.
For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. Please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen, and let me know what you think of the Flux Capacitor. You can find me on Instagram as the Brad Bradley, on LinkedIn, and through our website at electricity.ca. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page, this being episode 129. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including Scott's recommendation, The Coming Wave by Mustafa Soliman. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.